I call the Senate Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee to order. Good afternoon, members. We do have a quorum present. So today we will be hearing four bills, the first of which we will vote on and recommend to pass, and the last three will be laid over. And the first item on our agenda is Senate File 1376. Senator Port, to your bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bolden. I think it's 1367.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, this is the FHPAP bill that we heard and laid over last week or the week before the snow. We are bringing it back up, and I do have an amendment to it to sort of bring it into line with what we are talking about. This changes the amount from $100 million to $50 million. And the goal with this is to move it to finance and to the floor, hopefully quickly, to make sure that we are getting out the emergency rental assistance that our counties and grantees across the state are telling us they need for the current cycle that we are in for this grantee. And so some of the wording in the amendment is to allow for this money to be put out in the current RFP cycle that has already, people have already submitted their RFPs for, and this will fill additional need for that, not require a new RFP cycle, is really the goal of the amendment. Chair, if I could move the A4, please.
Senator Port moves the A4 amendment. Any questions on that, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion passes and the amendment is adopted. Senator Port.
Thank you. And members, again, as we talked about earlier, this goes through the organizations, the counties, and the FHPAP providers who already provide emergency rental assistance across the state. This is just an increase in funding, an immediate infusion of funding to ensure that we're meeting the needs that are out there right now and that we maintain stability as we are moving into what will hopefully be a historic investment in housing. We want to ensure that we keep people in stable housing in the meantime. And so I ask for your support to move this to finance.
Questions, members? All right, seeing none, Senator Port renews her motion that Senate File 1367, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion passes and the bill is on its way.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Port, moving on. The second item on our agenda is Senate File 1371. To your bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair. This is also a very short, simple bill. It just has one sentence that is changed. But the goal of this is really to keep investments that the state makes in affordable housing affordable as long as we possibly can. Right now, there is sort of an arbitrary date of 30 years on most affordability covenants, and this would put, if it has been made affordable through investments in the state for affordable housing, it would remove that 30-year limitation and allow it to be affordable for as long as we can possibly make it affordable. When the state's dollars go into a particular purpose, like building affordable housing, it is my belief, and I have folks from the agency here too as well, that we should maintain that use as long as we can. These are state dollars that went into it, and we should keep it affordable housing for as long as possible. I think there are testifiers as well.
Yes, Senator Port, we will move to testifiers. The first on my list is Dan Kitzberger. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Again, I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the legislative director at Minnesota Housing. I just want to thank Chair Port for carrying this bill. This is an agency policy bill that we've been trying to get across the finish line for a few years now. Just a bit of background, we currently, for most of our multifamily loan documents, are able to go to 40 years, and we've done that in collaboration with our developer partners and stakeholder partners who've, again, as Senator Port indicated, placed a priority on longer-term affordability. And so this prevents us from having to bring everybody back to the table at year 30 in order to continue the affordability covenant that travels with the property itself. So again, just thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions there might be.
Thank you, Mr. Kitzberger. Our second and I believe last testifier is Katie Topinka. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Katie Topinka. I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Relations for the City of Minneapolis. And the City of Minneapolis is pleased to testify in support of Senate File 1371. This item is on the city's legislative agenda as well. We have seen a growing need for affordable housing in our community. More than 50% of Minneapolis households are renter households. 73.4% of renters in Minneapolis experience housing cost burden, meaning they pay more than 30% of their income for housing. And more than half of renters are extremely housing cost burdened, meaning they pay more than 50% of their income for housing. The City of Minneapolis finances affordable rental and ownership housing units each year through programs like our Affordable Housing Trust Fund and the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program. In 2022, the city closed on the financing of 919 new affordable rental units, which was a historic high for the city. And since 2021, we approved funding for 196 affordable homeownership units. But statute does put some limitations in our ability to enforce affordability through a declaration longer than 30 years. And we would like to protect the significant public investment that the city is making in affordable housing and require longer affordability terms to ensure that units remain affordable well into the future. We support this bill so that we can work with community partners, affordable housing developers, and support renters and homeowners in our community by having longer affordability periods. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other comments, Senator Port? Senator Dreheim. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Port, is affordable housing related to this section defined?
Senator Port.
Either by reference to some other statute or by words that you want to add. Seems a little bit vague.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rest. I believe it is. I'm wondering if council can point to the particular part in statute.
They are looking for it. We'll give them a moment. I wonder if while they are looking, could we take another, Senator Rest, do you have other questions? Mm-hmm. Or we'll circle back to that, that's all right. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. I think mine was kind of under the same line. I was going to call for a friend, a nonpartisan, to kind of go through. To me, I agree with Senator Rest. It's very vague on 2.21 and 2.22. I agree of the notion of what you're trying to accomplish here. I just want a little better explanation of how this really impacts with current statute.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dreheim and Senator Rest. Talking with MHFA, we're not sure it's in statute, but is typically typically used in if it's a building or housing that has income restrictions on it. So that's sort of how the agency looks at it. I'd be happy to work with you guys and the agency to sort of build that piece out. We are going to lay this over, and so. I agree. It should be. It I'd be happy to clarify that.
Senator Dreheim.
I beat her. Thank you. I guess my question would be, I know some of the programs have affordability for like a decade, and then how would this impact some of the existing agency programs would be my question.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll defer to Mr. Kitzberger in a moment, but I will say this doesn't require different terms than what are negotiated between the property and the agency or anything. It just allows for, like as the City of Minneapolis was saying, that they have negotiated with some of their developers 40 years, but still at the end of 30 years, they have to go back because it's unenforceable, that agreement they have come to for a longer term, because the statute says after 30 years, it's done. So this doesn't require that that the terms be set there, but it allows for it.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dreheim, I just note this most frequently comes up with the multifamily properties financed by the federal low-income housing tax credit, where we're able to negotiate with developers in the loan documents affordability, usually up to 40 years. And so the programs that we have, most of which are appropriated at the agency, that may have shorter terms of affordability wouldn't be impacted.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. I guess, could it work the opposite way, I guess, would be my next question. So if you had a city that didn't want the affordability for some crazy idea for 5 years, could they do that, as vague as this is drafted?
Mr. Kitzberger.
Or would it go back to 2.18?
Yeah, but Madam Chair, Senator Dreheim, I guess I read that as this being in a category of covenants that for which there's a maximum of 30 years.
So if we, Chair.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. But would it be easier just to change 30 to 40? I want to get it right, and yeah. I think we all do on this table. So I think maybe if we could circle back would be wonderful.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Dreheim, I think we could do that, but then it would impact all of the other types of covenants in this section that are subject to this 30-year limit. So I think, I think we would want to avoid that if we can. So I think, we could possibly come up with a way to make sure that it's limited to just this section. And I think if we're able to not have it, or for this to not be, I think we'd need to give that some more thought.
Senator Rust.
Madam Chair and Senator Porter, I would just point out that almost all of the other conditions reference a statute that governs them or has much more specificity to it. And I just recommend adding a little bit more meat to it. Thank you very much.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rust. I don't think you're wrong. We are happy to continue to work on that.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion, members? All right, seeing none, this bill will be laid over for further consideration. And I will hand the gavel back to Chair Port.
Thank you, members.
This better not.
Thank you, members. We will move on to the third item of the agenda, which is Senate File 1372 from Senator Rest.
I was told that bill is going to be heard on Thursday. I do not have my bill file with me. I guess I can do it anyway, though, if you want.
Maybe perhaps while the agency's here, we could at least have their
I can do it.
Walkthrough of it.
I can do it. Madam Chair, 1372 was, I was asked by Senator Port to become the shepherd for this bill. So it is the agency bill, and the first section deals with the ability of the Housing Finance Agency to, with its authority for refunding bonds that they had originally issued. You may know that bonds that are issued for debt after you issue them, after a certain period of time, you may refund them. That means you can reissue them again at a different, usually a lower interest rate. The impact of that, some little bit good, little bit bad maybe, is that if you're going to refund a bond, it has to be callable, which means that it has somewhat of a specific maturity date that is going to be actionable for that bond. And generally, let's say a bond is not callable for a period of like 4 years. What that does is send a message to the bondholders that there is less of a risk in terms of purchasing those bonds. However, from the perspective of the agency, the goal in refunding a bond is to get a lower interest rate. There are two things that happen if that's passed. One, if that's done, one is the debt service that is transferred from MMB to the agency recognizes a lower interest payment. When that happens, then the it's not free money, but let's say the interest payment was under the current issuance is $100. Well, if you reissue it and the interest payment is only $90, you don't really get to keep the money that you saved. And the interest, the transfer from MMB to the agency in a following period is then adjusted so that everything is evened out. In Article 1, there is, in Section 2, there is permission given to the housing agency to issue nonprofit housing bonds that are authorized in subdivision in subdivision two. One of the then including things are things that are dealt with here are not only these nonprofit housing bonds that are issued to do the refunding, which was not specified previously, but the agency, the Housing Finance Agency, may also issue housing infrastructure bonds, which they were not able really to do or didn't start being able to do until, I understand it, something like 2008. And those conditions are explained in section four. Section five is the debt service that is going to be transferred, and it deals with the refunding of housing infrastructure bonds, and there's a correction on line 330, not calling them affordable bonds, but the correct term, or the more modern term on changing theirs, is housing infrastructure bonds. In in section six, the there's another reference to housing infrastructure bonds that was not there before, and that is in not only section or subdivision 5B, but also in C. So every time that they're talking about refunding, they're including now the housing infrastructure bonds issued under subdivision 2C. And that those phrases are just included all the way through the rest of Article 1. In Article 2, the term rehabilitation is now added for loan purpose, and that that language is at page 6, line 2 and 3, and it now is going to apply to accessory dwelling units, which I understand can be like a garage in your backyard or something like that. That's the most, I think, common understanding relative to how we don't call them accessory dwelling units. We call them a garage with a bathroom in it or something. Anyway, then in section two, there is an expansion of who is eligible to participate in these things. And at every point, Indian tribes are now being eligible for these programs. Then in section three, the housing agency has a lot of discretion with, rightly so, with how they prioritize where their dollars and authority are best spent. And that certainly comes up now. There is a directive in Section 3 that the agency, and this is on page 7, line 9, the agency must prioritize its use of appropriations for any program under this chapter. For what purpose? To serve households most affected by housing disparities. The agency uses its discretion to identify those populations. And we want them to do that because, and give them authority to do that because they change from time to time. And the agency, in my mind, is in the best, and obviously from there, since this is their bill, is in the best position to make those determinations. Then in section four, there is a special purpose credit program, which also may sound just a bit vague, but it really is not. It's just affirming, in my mind, talking about their obligation to look at households that are most affected by housing disparities, that they're given the authority to establish, and this is in page 7, line 13, to establish special purpose credit programs to do what? Well, to help those economically disadvantaged classes of persons that have experienced classic discrimination. And it so appropriately follows Section 3, where they have to do a prioritization for their use of appropriations. And if you look at 717 through 719, this program, you know, what can it do? Well, it can include a wide variety of remedies, so it's wide open, kind of, and then suggests in the final language what those remedies may be. So it says, including but not limited to loans or other financial assistance based on current documented need, again, as determined by the agency. So there's an overall directive, but that respects and honors the discretion of the agency in having these. Then Section 5, there has been a provision that in each of the 87 counties that the county board has to pass a, you know, kind of like a seconding resolution supporting the programs that come before them asking for a grant. And that is eliminated. That county resolution is no longer needed or desired, and it's proposed by the agency to eliminate them. In Section 6, there is an elimination starting at 8.15 of how those things may be used, and it's under, starts at 8.9, what bonds issued by the agency under those housing infrastructure bonds means what? It means the bonds ended issued by the agency, but is striking single family homes from that purpose. And then, interestingly enough, people who are older, what does it mean to be a senior when we are referencing senior senior housing? And what is being changed here is moving away from using a reference to an individual and instead substituting a definition and a new term called senior household. So that if you look at 825 and on, a senior household means a household with one or more senior members, and then there is an income restriction of 50% of the metropolitan AMI or the state AMI for people that live outside of seven county metropolitan area. Then further in 829, it is the replacement of the term senior households for senior, and I think that's a real improvement from my point of view from what the agency is doing, because it is maybe a more common understanding, not to pinpoint an individual qualifying, but the household, which may be one person, but it may be more than that. In section 9, there is the definition of eligible project area for these programs is specified that it is outside of the metropolitan of a metropolitan county, corresponding to doing it within the 7-county metropolitan area or those that are outside, so that it should be very clear who this program is intended for. And then in section 10, the commissioner, if you look at 1131, et cetera, the commissioner shall not award a grant or deferred loans to an outside, not to a city that's being struck, to an outside, to an eligible, I'm sorry, project area without certification by the eligible, read that back, by the, without certification, by the eligible project area. And it also includes expansion to include in both sections, so the last two sections, the federally recognized tribe. Then the section 11 does nothing to the amounts or anything, but includes not only acquisition and rehabilitation, but replacement. And so that's the word that's added there. So, Madam Chair, that's the bill.
Senator Rest, thank you for not being prepared to present that bill today. I think you did a beautiful job. So that was very in-depth, and thank you. I have on my testifier list Mr. Kitzberger. If he has anything to add, you might have covered it all. Mr. Kitzberger?
Madam Chair, I'm glad that was recorded, because that was masterful. I think there's, just regarding the, I think one thing I'd note regarding, where is that? The change in section 5 of Article 2. This has to do with our FHPAP, which, you know, is the bill we heard earlier, the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program. This county resolution provision was part of the original language, which the program is 30 years old now. And so really the impetus for that was to build familiarity and support for the program at a local level. 30 years into the program, it's well known, well supported, and an important part of the, you know, the statewide service mix. And so we just feel like that's an additional hurdle that's no longer needed. Other than that, I think I would maybe just leave it there and see whether there are any questions.
Senator Rest?
I do have one other comment. When I was looking at the bill over the weekend, in another area, there was a concern that a provision that dealt with financing and refunding bonds and so forth belonged in the public finance article of the tax bill. But and I sent an email copying yourself and Senator Lucero and the tax council. And it turns out that when
the agency is a separate body, and it's separate from the state even. And so it's governed by a different set of understandings when it is issuing bonds and refunding them. The public finance article in the tax bill deals with public finance issues, including refunding bonds and the rules for them, like for cities and local governments. But the Housing Finance Agency is unique. And so Article 1 definitely belongs in this committee.
Thank you, Senator Rest, and thank you for including me on that email. I think it was a very helpful way to sort of think about it in what can be a confusing sort of policy area. So, members, questions? Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Rest. Do you think it's wise to effectively eliminate MHFA's debt ceiling in Article 1, Section 1? I recognize that most of MHFA's funding doesn't come from state appropriations, but it would still have a massive impact on Minnesota if the agency were to engage in excessive borrowing, or worse yet, fail to meet the debt service obligations.
Senator Rest?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Housley. You know, that is a position taken, I mean, I can describe it, but that's a position taken by the agency that I would then ask them to defend.
Mr. Kitzberger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Housley, it's a little bit confusing because the term general obligation is used, but as Senator Rest was describing, this has to do with the agency's general obligation pledges made on bonds that are sold to finance single-family mortgages. And so those mortgages are being paid by mortgage holders. And so what we're proposing to do is clarify that it is just the agency's general obligation pledge that counts toward our debt ceiling, and not things like housing infrastructure bonds or even the general obligation bonds that we use for our public housing preservation program that are authorized by the legislature. And so I think one of the reasons for this is that for something like housing infrastructure bonds, we are already limited in how much new authorization we get by the legislature. And so we felt it was appropriate or it was duplicative and somewhat unnecessary to have that count against our debt ceiling. I think I'd just leave it there for the time being.
Follow-up, Senator Housley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where does this bill go from here?
We're planning to lay it over.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port. And thank you, Senator Rest, for bringing this bill forward. On the bonds, the general obligation bonds, as defined by do we need to define them in this chapter? Because you normally don't offer what we consider general obligation bonds. In fact, I don't think you probably have any general obligation bonds, do you, Mr. Kitzberger?
Mr. Kitzberger?
Madam Chair, Senator Drame, I think we have a little bit of authorization left from the last time. This would have been a couple of years ago that the state approved new GO authorization for public housing preservation.
Senator Dreheim.
So I guess my next question would be for nonpartisan. Do we need to define terms? Because my understanding, and from what I remember, it's a very small percentage of what we define as general obligation bonds that are authorized through the agency. So there would be no debt ceiling on any other type of bonds other than the GO bonds, which are hardly used. Is that correct?
Mr. Kitzberger?
Madam Chair, the GO bonds this is referencing are actually the general obligation, the bonds that carry a general obligation pledge from the agency that are used to back single-family mortgages. And so that's actually the vast majority of the work we do. I think we have, as of last summer, about $3.7 billion in that type of bond or in that type of debt outstanding.
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair and Senator Draham, I think there's, at first when I read this too, I had some of the same confusion. I think the word general obligation is a term that we think of everything that comes out of the capital investment bill. That is different than the, what they're calling general obligation here. The GO bonds that come out of the capital investment bill, the state is responsible for that. I think it's just a term that when used here, they're referring to their own bonds that are, as I was thinking of it, sort of twisting around the words maybe, that are obligated to the agency, maybe, instead of general obligation bonds. And, you know, maybe as this bill is laid over and we talk about it more, I might want to work with the agency to see if we can maybe restructure the way this section is worded so that it's not confusing between the GO bonds that we're all thinking about and what the bonds that they're actually describing.
Senator Draham.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Thank you, Chair Port. And I guess that's what I was getting at. Do we need to define these in 462A whatever? Because defining terms, as Senator Rest brought up earlier. So I look forward to that if they will work on that. And if I could, I have a couple more questions, if that's okay, Chair.
Senator Draham.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could just add a comment to that.
Senator Rest.
Is to really continue to keep in mind that the Minnesota Housing Agency is an entity apart. And everything that's in it is different because of it operates separately. And so general obligation bonds that are backed by the full faith and credit of the state and that capital investment bill, that's a different animal. But when it's within the agency, it is the calling it that and having the same characteristics is what makes those bonds attractive to purchasers because there is stability, there's guarantees that are made, and I quite frankly think that that is a general term that it doesn't need further further definition, but if you come up with something that expands it, saying general obligation, that, you know, I don't like purpose statements because we understand what a general obligation bond is, but that has a little bit of belt and suspenders to it that can make those who are uneasy with that term because it's not clearly separated from capital investment general obligation bonds. It works for me.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Draham, do you have another question?
I would love another question. Thank you, Chair Port. I guess my next question is on 6.1 or 6.3 on the accessory dwelling units. And I know we've had a lot of discussion over the last couple of years with those accessory dwelling units. And I know the league, I know, has had some issues with some of the stuff we've tried to do on that. Is there peace in the valley on these accessory dwelling units if we're going to be having additional funds for that?
I have no idea.
Mr. Kitzberger?
Madam Chair, Senator Draham, we haven't been made aware of any concerns from the league or Metro Cities in that regard. You know, should this be passed, you know, we would be subject to local zoning requirements and so would, you know, approve projects accordingly.
Senator Draham.
Thank you. My next one is on 7.10 on housing disparities. And we heard Senator Rast's explanation of that, but I guess my question would be, if this bill was enacted, who would be most affected by housing disparities today that the agency would focus on in this section of the bill?
Mr. Kitzberger? Senator Rast?
Well, I would think that the reason why I was presenting Section 3 and Section 4 together was that I found that in Section 4 in that Subdivision 44, that it was really related to the households that were affected by housing disparities. So it was the expansion, rather than being vague, it was the expansion of it, even though it's not quantified, in that this housing credit program is focused on persons on the basis of race, color, ethnicity, or national origin. And I would relate that back to housing disparities. Although you might think it's a weak link. Well, I mean, but the housing agency, they need that kind of discretion in order to be reminded of it, what they must do, what they may do, and they are reminded of it by these two sections. But we don't want to, in defending their bill here, we don't want to totally tie everything down. And if you think it's not, that it still needs some specificity, I'm sure that they're willing to adjust that, maybe not so much in the special purpose credit program, so not so much in Subdivision 44, but maybe in additional language in Subdivision 43.
Mr. Kitzberger?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Dram. And just to add to what Senator Rast was mentioning, related to Subdivision 43, I think it would really kind of depend upon the program. So I think a good example might be the Homeownership Assistance Fund or down payment assistance. You know, we know the most egregious disparities are between Black households and white households. So that's a program where the emphasis may be a little bit different, or we may partner with or try strategies that would reach Black households versus, say, our prevention dollars. You know, we know that the American Indian population is, I think, more represented among the homeless population, certainly than they are among their population in the state, but also among other groups. And so we may think differently about strategies to reach American Indian populations with our prevention resources.
Senator Drahan.
Thank you, and thank you both for your response. I guess where I was going with the leading question was, why aren't they, you know, is the agency doing something about it now, or why isn't the agent doing something about it now, I guess was my point I was trying to get at on both 7.14 and 7.1. So thank you for that response. And then on 8.15, you have eliminated single-family homes. Mr. Kitzberger, can you elaborate on that?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Drahan, this language is actually duplicative, and it's the way it's drafted has always been somewhat confusing. We actually have the authority to do this if you look at this part of statute in 462A 3.37, that's the Housing Infrastructure Bond statute. If you look at subdivision 1, I believe it's paragraph F, clause 4 is what gives us the authority to do single family homeownership development out of that resource.
Senator Drahan.
Thank you. And can you repeat that, Mr. Kitzberger?
462A.
462A.37, it's subdivision 1, paragraph F, clause 4.
Thank Senator Drahan?
I'm almost done, Chair. Sorry.
It's all right.
And then I guess getting back to the disparity question I had, do we, and this is probably a nonpartisan question, do we need to define that term in Chapter 462A? And we don't need the answer now, but I think that's something I think we need to have. And I know the author wants to keep it vague, and I can appreciate her wishes there. But
I would say not vague, Madam Chair, Senator Dreheim.
Flexible.
But, you know, flexible and inclusive.
We'll take a look at it, Senator Dreheim and Senator Rest. We can talk about it together with the agency as we move closer to putting this all into a policy bill.
I have one more question, if
Senator
I could,
Dreheim.
Chair, and then I promise I will be done. On the sale of the bonds, Mr. Kitzberger, I assume that the agency is going to factor in the cost of selling bonds. I'm sure there's an expense to that, and I would love to know that, but not now in here. But at some time, maybe we could talk about that online.
Mr. Kitzberger?
Madam Chair, Senator Dreheim, I'd actually like to know more about that, too. So yeah. I'll see what I can find out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rest, or Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one quick question. On line 6.2, where it says rehabilitation may include the addition of the addition or rehabilitation of a detached accessory dwelling unit, has the agency considered allowing for the replacement of the ADU? That could be maybe, instead of just the addition or the rehab, it could be more cost effective. And I know in other parts of the bill you've added that word.
Yeah. Mr. Kitzberger.
Senator Port, or Chair Port, Senator Housley, that's a good question. I'd like to find out more about that from program staff.
Members, any final questions? Seeing none, Senator Rest, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to thank very much the assistance of Bill Freeman in preparing a testimony on the bill today.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Rest, for presenting even when you we're not quite ready. I think you did a masterful job. And members, this will be laid over for possible inclusion as we move forward. And the final item on the agenda is Senate File 821. Senator Pa. Welcome to the table, Senator Pa. Please go ahead and proceed with the introduction of your bill.
Thank you, Chair Port and committee members, for the opportunity to present my bill, SF821. This bill expands the ability of tenants to request emergency repairs and also places additional requirements on landlord to maintain their properties, including by maintaining a minimum temperature of at least 68 degrees within a unit between October 1st and April 30th. This language significantly expands the cases in which a tenant can petition a court for emergency repairs. If a tenant does petition for emergency relief in one of these cases and has notified the landlord, giving them at least 24-hour notice, the court can order a landlord to immediately fix a violation in the issues there. The language also allows the court to charge conciliation court filing fees for these petitions. This change lowers the court, the current filing fee of $300 to the current standard for conciliation or small claims court, which is $75. With that, I do have some testifiers here, and then open to questions.
Thank you, Senator Pa. And I will, members, just point to you, there is a one-pager in your packets on this as well. And then Mr. McDonough from Homeline, if you would come up and testify first. Catherine Bamberry, you will be next. And then we have an online testifier after that. Mr. McDonough, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Port. My name is Laurie McDonough. I'm a policy attorney with Homeline, and I've been here before, but just a very brief background. I've been a housing attorney for about 39 years, coming up on 40, but I'm not quite there yet. I've assisted about 10,000 former clients, including mostly tenants, but also a lot of nonprofit landlords. And I've been off and on landlord myself for about 30 years. So about the heat code, this would have a minimum code, temperature for essentially the winter months. I've been here long enough that I realize winter is longer than it used to be, and so we're really talking the winter months here. And the problem we have right now is there's really a hodgepodge of minimum heat requirements around the state. A lot of cities don't have them. Some do. Some have more facility kind of obligations, but not an actual temperature obligation. And at Homeline, we receive hundreds of calls each year about problems with habitability, including heat issues. And so this would simply kind of make the practice uniform across the state. I can say as a former landlord that this type of obligation would not have harmed me in any way. In terms of the emergency repair list, I can focus on this a little more as a litigator. We have a decent list of emergency repair problems in the emergency tenant remedy statute. And there's a catch-all there. And I was actually involved with the drafting of the statute back in 1989. And my view at that time was that the catch-all provision would be enough to deal with emergencies that we had not contemplated at the time. But we've definitely had resistance from the courts over the years at saying, well, you already got a list of several things here, so why should we go further? And so we looked at what are some of the really emergency problems that folks have that weren't on that list. And so that's the reason for expansion of the list, so that the courts, not only the courts, but landlords and tenants will know that this is something that's of a more emergent nature rather than something that we'll get to it when we want. And lastly, about court filing fees. These types of cases, lockout cases, emergency tenant remedies cases, they tend to go through the court system relatively quickly. So we're not talking about cases that go on for years. We're talking about cases that go on for days or weeks. And so having a reduced filing fee, I think, makes sense from a judicial economy standpoint. But also, if you have a reduced filing fee for a non-emergency case, like a rent escrow action, it seems like kind of common sense that for the emergency actions, we wouldn't want to have a financial burden there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. Ms. Bamberry, will you please come up to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Banbury, and I am both a tenant in St. Paul, and I'm also a tenant organizer with Homeline. I'd like to read a few testimonies from tenants that could not be here today. This is from a tenant in Minneapolis. I lived in this home for 7 years. The furnace would frequently malfunction. Maintenance told the landlord he needed a new furnace. The guy just kept putting different parts in. I went into my own pocket and paid $500 to get the furnace repaired. Every other year, the furnace would still go out. I would have to stay in a hotel because it would get so cold, and he only gave me a space heater. I wasn't able to heat our house over 50 degrees. I went through a lot of suffering in that house. This is from a tenant in Roseville. In June of 2021, my air conditioning broke on an incredibly hot weekend. The replacement they brought in didn't fit, and they never came back. I reached out before the summer of 2022, but it was another 5 weeks before they came to install a new unit. The new one was also busted. A large rainstorm caused my apartment to flood through the AC unit. I asked about mold, and my landlord said that mold wasn't an issue, and that's not how mold worked. When I moved out, I showed them the damage and the mold, and they asked me why I had never said anything. Even though I had submitted multiple work orders, I'm done with this whole situation. And one more from Minneapolis. The flooding in the basement was likely caused by an attempt at old home repair. It looks like the landlord tried to wash the spackle down the drain, which caused a water flow stoppage. Every time we use the washer, it floods in the basement about an inch. The foundation is tilted, so all the water pools into a room that is filled with black mold. Every time the water touches the mold, it flares up, and you can smell it through the house. They have taken no steps to address this as of yet. They have been renting out this house for a while with this same problem. As far as I know, there's basically black mold in every wall in the house. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Banbury. And then we have one testifier online. Mr. Smith, you can come off mute and please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I am President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, which represents 2,200 members with approximately 300,000 units of housing. I come to you today to raise concerns regarding Senate File 821. A statewide minimum heating code does not recognize the regional differences in our large state, especially north to south. Additionally, the minimum heat code does not recognize how many multifamily rental properties heat their facilities. Most commonly, older facilities use a boiler system, which creates constant heat flow throughout our building. The boiler system causes those in the center to be warmer than those in the upper level corners, which tend to remain cooler. For example, I have a property where there are heating lines that run 100 feet to the north and 100 feet to the south, and the units closer to the boiler are obviously warmer than those at the other end, which maintaining 68 degrees during a polar vortex means that the units closer to the boiler are incredibly warm and wasteful of energy while we try and maintain 68 degrees under those extreme circumstances. Notwithstanding that we're often asked by the energy provider to lower thermostats under those circumstances so that other folks can actually maintain service. This language is a one-size-fits-all that doesn't match the significantly different climate and heating systems in the multifamily sector. Our local housing maintenance codes can be applied in circumstances to reflect the local heating requirements and have done it in many municipalities. Further, the extension of ETRA to include appliances is problematic because it does not take into account the nature of our property management business practices, especially as it relates to appliances. For example, when replacing or repairing an air conditioner unit, it is entirely a seasonal activity. Our suppliers understandably have specific quantities of inventory available at the beginning of a season. If an air conditioner breaks at the end of the season and the part is no longer available, or a replacement unit is no longer available, then we're faced with a challenge of meeting the necessity to provide an appliance. How can we comply with the ETRA in that circumstance? We can obviously financially compensate the residents, supply fans, among other options to mitigate the situation. In the case of a disability-related necessity for air conditioning, then there are a reasonable accommodation would need to be made. My testimony today outlines a few concerns that we have and why we have those concerns with the proposals. We believe we can work with the author, the chair, and the committee to address these issues. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll go to member questions, amendments, concerns. Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually have a series of questions. But my first question actually is something I hadn't thought of with the testifier there, Mr. Smith, in regards to boiler systems. My experience has been not in multifamily scenarios, but in single-family scenarios. But in the multifamily scenario, he brought up a good point. And as he was telling us the story, I'm thinking back to one of my very first apartments. We were on the third floor of a multifamily situation, and in the winter it was so hot, we actually had to have our windows open most of the winter because on the third floor the heat rose, and we were in the middle of the building, not on the edges or the ends with the more exterior wall or multiple exterior walls. So my question, Madam Chair, is what are the chief author's thoughts in that scenario whereby in order to achieve in this system, a boiler system at the extremities of multifamily building, to get that 68, what are your thoughts on the implications of the more interior spaces?
Senator Pah.
Thank you, Chair Port, and thank you, Senator Lucero, for that question. I understand that those situations do happen in a lot of our multifamily units, especially apartments. But the thing is this, there are some units that are hot, but there are some units that are super cold. When it's hot, you can at least open the window and have a reasonable temperature that's livable. But when you're cold, you don't have a secondary heat source. And so you're saying that families who are living in those units that are cold are kind of stuck. They're going to have to live 6 months out of every year in a cold environment, which they cannot change, and it's under 68 degrees. They don't have an option to heat their space unless the landlord can supply a secondary heat source. I mean, that's something they can put into those units in a safe way that can make sure that the environment is at 68 degrees or above. If they know that that's something that exists within their units, they can definitely make sure that they have a second heat source so that they can keep the other units at the 68 and not have to jack it up so that by the time the people in the outer corner units are comfortable, the inner center or the top units are super hot. But I understand what you're saying, but it's not okay for some to be comfortable and the others to be super cold versus, again, when you're hot, you can open the window. When you're cold, you can't really do anything.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. So would it be an acceptable solution for a housing provider to provide a space heater in a room like that? So it's electric space heater, whereby the boiler system, presumably running off natural gas, the heat might be provided by the housing provider in those scenarios where it might be the end of the building or an exterior wall or an unusually colder bedroom to provide an electric-based space heater that is in the tenant's responsibility to pay for that electricity. Would that be an acceptable solution?
Senator Pa.
Thank you, Chair Port, and thank you, Senator Lucero. I wouldn't recommend that the landlord supply a portable space heater because those may have its own hazard attached to it. But what is recommended is that the landlord could find a secondary heat source such as a fixed electric heater, so that's something that's fixed onto a wall or so it's not portable. And it the other thing is a heat pump or electric heater with thermostat or a wood or pellet burner or a flue gas heater. These are secondary heat sources that could be options besides their primary heat source.
Senator Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just to be clear then, regardless of what's recommended, regardless of what might be cost effective or not, would it be in compliance with the law, if this were to become law, to provide whether it's a space heater, a fixed heater, electric, or other source, would it be in compliance then with this? In this scenario, let's just say it is a space heater. Portable space heater, would that comply with law, whether or not it's recommended?
Senator Pa. Mr. McDonough.
Thank you, Senator Port and Senator DeLucero. Yes, it would. It would depend on if there was any other local code provision that regulated different types of facilities for heat. But what this bill does, it sets the temperature. It doesn't set the method.
Senator Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that actually will lead into my next question or next series of questions. So looking at the first page of the bill on line 1.9, actually looking at the second page, 2.3, it's speaking about supply or furnish heat, and it goes on to line 2.5, any wall. So I'm then going back in the bill, well, any wall to what? And then so I get up to line 1.9 where it says premises. Now, obviously, this is language that's existing. It's not language you're changing. But I'm trying to figure out what you are changing on line 2.5, any wall, and per line 1.9 in subdivision 1, it's the premises. So I asked research staff, is there a statutory definition, while we were leading up to this bill, is there a definition to premises? Because, again, I'm wearing my hat now of single-family home, not multi-unit type of housing. And so in the single-family homes, there's attached garages, there's detached garages, there's heated garages, there's insulated, not heated, and then there's not heated or insulated. And so I want to know, when you say any wall, right, per the line there, and then it's in regards to premises, research got back and said apparently there is no statutory definition for premises in Minnesota code, so that... in that case, then, they found a Minnesota Court of Appeals opinion that has to interpret the meaning of premises, since there's an absence of statutory definition. And I won't read the whole thing, but essentially, when the statute fails to specifically define the term, we construe the word, and this is from the Court of Appeals ruling, we construe the word according to its common and approved usage, and it goes on to say that premises as... the buildings on it or both. So the land or the buildings or both. Okay, so when I'm thinking buildings, garages are buildings. And since we're looking at this, so is it your intent then that you're using any wall and per the Court of Appeals interpretation in a premises, any wall would include structures on the land and in a single family home rental context, there are garages that are attached, detached. Do those need to be heated? Why or why not?
Senator Pa.
I'll defer that to Mr.
McDonough.
Okay. Senator Port and Senator Lucero. It's the intention not to include garages. When you have a single-family home, and with apartment buildings and the like, it's really for the places where people reside. My read of this bill is that would be how it would be interpreted. But we'd certainly be open to some language that would make that clear. It's certainly not the intent to have the shed in the backyard where you keep the tools and the snowmobile to be heated to 68 degrees.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So it does need to have some work because the word any wall does mean any wall for premises and the Court of Appeals, so I appreciate the recognition that does need to be examined. And in addition to that, so let me give another scenario. So as I've explained in this committee several times in the past, the single family homes that I rent out, some of them are built in late 1800s, early 1900s, 1920 timeframe. And there are, you can imagine, over the course of more than 100 years, these homes are a compilation of additions over the decades. And so they have a mixture of all kinds of different materials, construction materials, insulation. In some, I've literally pulled out newspaper as the insulation for an exterior wall. There is sawdust as the insulation for an exterior wall. The sawdust, after 100 years, having settled, and it's literally only the first maybe 36 inches from the floor, the rest of it's a wide open cavity. Wouldn't know that unless one is performing renovation. And so then obviously modern forms of construction, you have fiberglass and you have spray foam, right? So there's all kinds of different stuff. Among that, there are porches in these homes. So at one point, I don't know if it was a purely exterior space and somebody enclosed it with a series of storm windows, and it's now, I don't know if you'd call it an interior space, but I think most people looking at these, what might have been a porch external at some point, is now an interior space. And so I'm thinking in one scenario, I have a home where the front door, the lock, doorknob and deadbolt is on the exterior door that leads into the porch. The porch is a completely unheated space. It must have been in some addition 70 years ago. I have no idea. Or they closed it in 70 years ago. There's no source of heat in it whatsoever. Then there's another door that's not locked per se because it's not the exterior door to the property, but one can close that door to close off the temperature in the interior space that's immediately inside the exterior door. So my question, Madam Chair, with that background, in this language, if this were to become law, is that porch area that's unheated, would I now, as the housing provider, have to go through the expense to heat that space and therefore then jack up the rents of my tenants?
Senator Pa.
Senator Lucero, I would say no. It depends on whether or not that porch is intended to be a 3 or 4 season porch and advertised or promised as much. If it's promised to be a 4 season porch, yes, it should be adequately heated. If it's a porch that's meant to be not 3 or 4 season and that is understood by the tenant, then no, you wouldn't have to heat that at 68 degrees or higher. So, I mean, just like Minnesota has a lot of these front porches that are not 3 or 4 season porch, they're not expected to be heated. It's only if it's an attachment of which you're saying, this is a 4 season porch, then yes.
Senator Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not advertising it at all. Here's a single family home. I'm not calling out that space and singling it out and advertising it one way or another. But in my opinion, I would consider it interior space because it's immediately behind the exterior door, which has the deadbolt, right? So I would look at it as an interior space. And when I see this here, any wall, but regardless, even if it is a 3 or 4 season porch, even if it were advertised or not advertised, can you show me where in the language that what you were articulating there would be the case? Because I see any wall, so even a 3 season porch attached to the home, how did you make that determination separate from the word any wall?
Senator Pa, Mr. McDonough?
Senator Port and Senator Lucero, you're right that language is not specific on that level. I agree with Senator Fahd that interpreting the statute for the benefit of the health and safety of tenants that are residing in the property, that the courts have the ability to essentially answer that question, but it's certainly possible that we could look at some language on that. I mean, I've litigated a lot of these cases, habitability cases over the years, and I can tell you that the courts, regardless of what their kind of judicial philosophy is, looks at the impact of the conditions on a person, right? So to give you an example, I have an adult daughter with special needs, and when I was helping her learn how to walk, the difference between having a hand railing for myself was minimal. But having a hand railing for my daughter was really, really important. And if we were in a case about that, the judge or the referee would look at, well, what's the impact of this railing not being there on my household? And if I'm able-bodied, then maybe there's no impact. But if I have, it's affecting me in a negative way, then the courts take action on it. And so when I look at this language here, the idea that a court would be saying to a landlord, you need to heat the shed in the back, seems pretty remote to me, that the landlord would have to heat a 2-season porch when nobody is spending any time in that porch other than taking off their shoes, seems equally unlikely.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me look at the time here because I definitely don't want to. Oh, we've got all kinds of time. Thank you for that answer. But in order to go to court, a housing provider has to go through an incredible amount of expense, likely hiring an attorney at probably a minimum of $250 an hour. And those costs, while a court may rule in the favor of a housing provider, there's still an expense there. And so where does that expense go? Even if the housing provider prevails, I have to pass the costs on to my that immediate tenant for that property, but not just that property, all of my tenants, right, in order to make sure that my costs are paid for. And so understand that going to court, if you pass a law that's vague and requires court action, even if the housing provider prevails, there's costs incurred. And that cost is going to be passed on. And I don't think we already have high prices, whether it be mortgages or rents. We have an opportunity to be very clear. And so we can be clear now what we mean, rather than being vague and requiring a court common sense. By the way, in my scenario, it wasn't a two-season. I would call it a completely, I'm using the word porch. I don't know if it's a porch. It probably was a porch at one point in the past. I would call it a completely interior space that's not heated. And per the plain reading of this language, that's going to require me to have to heat that at 68 degrees. And it's, by the way, it's also not insulated. So even if I were to heat it, right, it's all storm windows. The whole thing is all storm windows. From probably, I'm guessing, maybe 36 inches, maybe less, maybe 30 inches off the ground all the way up to the ceiling. Storm windows. And it's not an 8-foot ceiling. It's probably a 7.5, maybe 7-foot ceiling. So it's not insulated. So if I'm required to put a heater in there of any kind, regardless, natural gas, whatever it might be, incredibly inefficient. And the other committee that I'm on, Madam Chair, on the Energy Committee, we are obviously very conscious about efficiency, energy efficiency, and not wasting energy in any capacity. And so again, just recognize that there's vagueness here that I think needs to be dealt with. Another scenario I throw out there is, in these 100-year-old homes, they don't have cement basements or cement slabs in the basement. They have dirt floors and fieldstone foundation. None of it's insulated. And so the cellar, as I would call it, potentially, it's in interior space. It's in the home. There are items a tenant can access it and can put storage on it if they want. But it may not be 68 degrees down there. So it may be 60 degrees down there. Would I be required then in these dirt floor, fieldstone foundation basements in these homes, would I be required then to go through the thousands of dollars of expense to insulate and heat that in order to satisfy the language before us?
Senator Lucero, I will interrupt and say I think this has been asked and answered, and there has been willingness from the author to work on ensuring that this is covering the livable spaces. And so I would ask that we move on from that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move on to the next page then, page 3. So in page 3, it speaks about several items here. And I won't ask these as a series of questions. I'll just throw these out there for consideration. In line 3.2, you have the word serious. Well, what does serious mean when it comes to infestation? And in my mind now, I'm thinking of box elder bugs. So as I'm sure most of us know, box elder bugs, they come out in April, and then they go back in under your siding in October. And in my own primary residence, in April, next month, I will have thousands of box elder bugs covering my garage door and my front door. And in about 2 weeks, they'll be gone. Would that be an infestation? I don't know. I don't know what the definition is here, and the word serious is a couple hundred box elder bugs, but that's April and October. All winter long, then, we've got box elder bugs on the interior space, not by the hundreds, but I would say over the course of the winter months, maybe several dozen, that'll be on the walls, crawling across the carpet, whatever. Is that an infestation? Is that serious?
Senator Pa. Mr. McDonough.
Yes, Senator Port and Senator Lucero. I've been involved with drafting legislation going back to 89. Not all questions can be answered with specificity when you're passing a bill. I mean, every bill that comes in here is going to have some room for interpretation. A serious infestation, in my view, would not be what you're describing. I can tell you I've never had a tenant in 39 years come and complain about box elder bugs. I've had box elder bugs myself. In my other life, I'm a pianist. I played in a church where the box elder bugs were actually landing on the piano. I got through it. It was a little unnerving. The kinds of infestations that I've gotten from clients are bed bugs, roaches, mice, and rats. That's where I've seen it. So this part of the bill is to create a basis for an emergency court case. Courts, when they see these cases, they have to evaluate, is this an emergency or not? That's the type of action. If the court determines that it's not an emergency, it grants no relief to the tenant. I've seen that happen, not often, because the cases I've seen, in my view, the emergencies were pretty obvious. So a serious infestation provision here gives the court the ability to make the determination, is this an emergency or not?
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in order to go to court, as I said before, there has to be a court filing and there has to be expenses paid, even if the housing provider prevails. And that's what I'm trying to avoid here. You probably disagree, Madam Chair. The testifier probably disagrees with my following words, and that is, we seem to be an increasingly litigious society. So the experience of 30 years ago or the experience of 20 years ago may not be the experience as today. And if I'm correct that we are an increasingly litigious society, there are more frivolous lawsuits being filed, perhaps because there's a dispute between a landlord-tenant in a completely different matter, but just out of spite, if there is legislation that allows for a court filing to occur, they will file it just to harass the housing provider on a frivolous thing. And so that's what I'm concerned about, is wasting time and costing money. The next thing, and I won't ask this question, I'll just point this out. The next question would be, when I'm reading line 3.26, a non-functioning refrigerator. I had a refrigerator in one of my units that had the water dispenser ice maker. It was a capability, but it wasn't functioning. Everything else about it was functioning, but this particular tenant really wanted an ice maker. It wasn't functioning. Now, and we looked it up, we wanted to replace that, but the unit that was required there for the replacement part was no longer in existence. So I would love to have repaired $100, $150 part, but it literally wasn't available. My only option to replace that refrigerator was to spend $1,700 to satisfy this tenant. When I read this language, non-functioning refrigerator, again, it's not very specific, and we have an opportunity to be more specific because, as I've said before, Madam Chair, there are certainly deadbeat housing providers, but there are also deadbeat tenants who waste time, and they make frivolous accusations, and they cost money. And I can very much see the scenario where a non-operating ice maker in a refrigerator could fall within the definition of a non-functioning refrigerator. Lastly, there's just a number of things in here. I'll look at 3.27. If included in the lease in regards to the air conditioner, while we were looking, having the other bill hearings here, I quickly looked up my leases. I have access to OneDrive here. I looked up a lease. I did a quick keyword search. I don't have the word air conditioner in any of my lease, so it's not specified. So I guess when I read this language, what does it mean, if included in the lease? So can an air conditioner that's present and attached to the house, whether it be central AC or whether it be a series of window units throughout the property, but I don't have any reference to them whatsoever in the lease, would a central air conditioning unit that burns out for whatever reason, in the middle of a supply chain crisis and not able to get a replacement unit, and or, as we heard one of the testifiers say, at the end of the summer season, where even in the absence of a supply chain crisis, there might be low inventory and you can't get your hands on a replacement parts or a whole unit right away, would I be in violation of this, yes or no, even if I don't have it specified in the lease? Just some thoughts, again, the vagueness, and I think we have an opportunity here to clean some of this up and tighten it up. So I hope the chief author is willing to indulge some of these concerns. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lucero. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Paul, for bringing the bill forward. My question has to do with the temperature of 68. Being a gentleman that does not like it hot, 68 is very hot for me. Would the temperature have to be at 68, or could I choose to lower that temperature?
Senator Pa.
So when we talk about the temperature of 68, this is only for units in which the tenant cannot control the temperature themselves. So this is like a multi-family unit in which the tenant within their own unit has no control over the temperature. It would be that they would have to be maintained at 68. Now, if you have control over your own thermostat and your temperature, you can change it to whatever you want. But in that case, then it would be 68 if you have no control.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. So would this encourage landlords to control our thermostats? Because I, in my apartment in St. Paul, I did have my landlord go in and turn the temperature all the way up to 70. And I keep it at 63. And, you know, so I'm concerned with the vagueness in the language that that would happen, that we wouldn't have control over our units. So as this moves forward, I think the more detail we can have on it, because I don't want the scenarios that Senator Lucero talked about, I think, are real. I think it needs a little more definition if we're going to move forward with this. I have managed hundreds of units, and I've never had a complaint that the landlord was keeping the temperature too low. I have had complaints that things break. And fortunately, when I managed those units, we did not have the supply chain issues that we have today. You know, I just replaced my furnace in my house a week ago. And it's costly and timely to get a unit in, especially energy efficient unit, which is what I think we all want. So I thank you for bringing the bill forward. I do think we need to work on it if it's the chair's prerogative to move forward with it. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Powell, for bringing this bill forward. I agree with Senator Dreheim and Lucero. We could tighten it up a little bit in the language. That would help. Are we, Madam Chair, maybe you will know, are we going to get a fiscal note with this since the courts will be required to charge the fee or collect the fees?
Senator Pod, do you know if there's been a fiscal note requested? I have not seen a request.
Chair Port, Senator Housley, no, I'm not aware of that, but we can definitely look at that.
We'll look into it.
Oh, there was one in the last session.
Okay, we'll look into it, Senator Housley.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just real quick, and I appreciate the indulgence. In regards to the temperature control, and the response I heard from the chief author was that if the temperature isn't within the control of the tenant, then these things have to apply. And that, as I read the language, I don't see that. I don't see any condition that the tenant may or may not be within the control of the temperature. So if I'm missing it, I'm just wondering if the chief author could confirm where I'm missing that.
I will just maybe jump in here quick and say to supply or furnish heat at a minimum temperature, if your tenant has the ability to turn their heat up to 68, to me that says you are supplying their heat at that temperature. So if they have control and are able to turn their heat up to 68, I believe you're meeting the requirements of this. That would be
correct.
My reading of it.
Senator Port.
Senator Pa.
Chair Port, Senator Lucero, that is correct. When you're already allowing the ability to control their heat, then they have the responsibility of making sure that their heat is to their liking and up to standards. Now, if they choose something different, that's up to them. But again, the heating unit has to work and has to have the ability to heat it up to that temperature. Now, if the heating unit only has the ability to heat up to 50 degrees, then you've got an issue. You're going to have to fix that. Okay.
Senator Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate that. I see a gray area there. When I read the word supplier furnish, I guess when I read that, I interpreted that to mean to make available, to make a capability exist. So while I, as a housing provider, I am providing a heating source, am I supplying it? I'm making it available. They can choose to do what they want with it, but I just don't see any condition in there. So again, just another opportunity to maybe tighten the language up, to be more clear if you, the intention is, when it's clearly not within the control, not within the control of the tenant, those words could be added again, make to eliminate that vagueness. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pott, any closing comments before we lay this bill over?
No, thank you, Chair Port.
Okay, thank you. Members, we're gonna lay this over for possible inclusion. That is the last item before us. Oh, Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port, and great hearing. My question is about Friday.
My announcements.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah, members, we are planning to meet both Thursday and Friday this week at 12:30. I hope we can keep it tight, but we have 4 additional bills that we really need to get through to close out the tenants' bills that we have this session. So between Thursday and Friday, we will get to the end of that, which will allow us to move forward with sort of a tenants' omnibus package, which we will hear the following week and then move to judiciary. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Port. And I just want to make a couple comments on that. One is I didn't see anything posted yet as of 12:20 or whatever.
They have been. They went up at 1:06.
Okay. And then so we know the bills that we'll be hearing on Friday. And just so members understand that, you know, most of us in the rural areas do have commitments already, and I was supposed to tour a school down in Winnebago that they had a whole bunch of stuff lined up for at the same time our committee will be meeting. So very disappointed we are meeting on Friday when us rural members that drive hours to see our constituents can't do that, and now we have to cancel. So,
thank you, Senator Dreheim, and I am sympathetic to that. I wish we didn't have to meet on Friday either, but with missing the committee last week for the snow, unfortunately, to stay on deadline, we do need to add some time. Happy to work with you in your office to see if joining virtually is an option that helps you, and happy to work through that. Members, any other questions about those 2 days? Senator Rest.
So I have 2 different times listed for the committee. What time is it?
On Friday?
On Friday.
12:30.
It is 12:30.
Yes. Okay. All right, members, and with no other business before us, we are adjourned. I will see you Thursday.